start the tax committee. Charlie, is the tape on?
Yes.
Okay, members, we're going to come to order. I'm going to be, I have to go make a, do a roll call quickly, and if Representative Loeffler could chair for a minute, I'd appreciate it.
Just take up the dab.
Okay. I didn't grab the pencil, but I'll be okay.
Ooh.
She doesn't need that. Representative Dabney. Oh, somebody's flash drive. I'm sure they'll appreciate getting that back.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. We don't yet have a quorum, so we are going to begin, Representative Dabney, with you overviewing your bill, and then we'll move it when we have a group to work on.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Could I ask staff just to clarify for me that members have the A3 amendments in their packets? They do. Okay, thank you very much. When we get around to it, I'd like to move the A3 amendment. Members, this is the Tobacco Modernization and Compliance Act of 2010. It updates Minnesota's tobacco laws to meet up really with the modern tobacco marketplace in Minnesota and across the country. There's a great deal of innovation and creativity in the tobacco marketplace, and while I generally like innovation and creativity, there are real issues before us when it's in the tobacco marketplace. And perhaps most importantly, I should speak personally as a father with the concerns that I have that the innovative products that are not currently covered by Minnesota law and that are proposed to be covered by House File 3467 will help keep the next generation of cigarette and tobacco products out of the hands of the next generation of Minnesota's children. I place that as a high priority for my family. I believe that families and communities across the state want to keep tobacco products out of the hands of minors, out of the marketing to minors, and out of the access to minors. And the House File 3467 does that. It's a common sense proposal that is a win-win for Minnesota, the children and families in our communities. With me today, Madam Chair, is Kerry Gordon from Clearway, Minnesota. I could go through the A3 amendment very briefly, or we could turn it over to Ms. Gordon, whatever would be the Chair's preference. Are we at a point where we have a quorum?
Representative Dabney, no. We are not yet okay. At a point of a quorum, but why don't we have you explain the amendment, and hopefully we'll achieve that soon.
All right. Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members, the A3 amendment includes little cigars, which are actually sold as cigarettes, under the definition of cigarettes, but deletes the provision that was in the bill as introduced requiring little cigars to hold to the same fire safe policies as cigarettes are. This has been worked out with the State Fire Marshal's Office. It applies tobacco taxes to the new innovative tobacco products currently escaping appropriate taxation due to the legal definition of these products in state statute. It prohibits the free distribution of these new consumable tobacco products, much as we prohibit the free distribution of cigarettes in the state. It provides local authorities with the same authority to regulate tobacco-related products as they currently have over traditional tobacco products. It extends the prohibition of the sale of tobacco products to minors to tobacco-related devices such as e-cigarettes, including the requirements that they be displayed only behind the counter of retail stores, and continues to protect retailers with an affirmative defense for the sale of tobacco-related products and devices to minors as currently exists for the sale of tobacco. That, Madam Chair, in summary, is the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. I think then we'll proceed with your testimony. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, and members of the committee. My name is Kerry Gordon, and I am the Senior Public Affairs Manager at Clearway, Minnesota. Clearway, Minnesota is an independent nonprofit organization that was founded with the tobacco, 3% of the tobacco settlement, and our mission is to reduce the harm tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. I'm also pleased to be testifying on behalf of the coalition of organizations supporting this bill that include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, Blue Cross Blue Shield Health Partners, Local Public Health Association, among others. As Representative Dabney mentioned, we're here today before you because the tobacco industry has continued to evolve and innovate for the 21st century, and unfortunately Minnesota's tobacco laws and regulations are stuck in the 20th century. And the disparity that that creates, creates some significant problems with significant impacts. So the bill before you today really is essentially a housekeeping bill that we think will help close the gap between the reality of what we're seeing in the tobacco marketplace and the tools that Minnesota currently has in order to properly assess and enforce tobacco tax collections, as well as prevent kids from having access to this whole new generation of tobacco products. So we think that this is a common sense piece of legislation that will help Minnesota really address the reality of what we're seeing in the marketplace. And it is a significant step forward in terms of addressing the issues that we are seeing today, but it also provides the opportunity to address issues that we see coming in the very near future. So it allows us to get a step ahead of what we know could be coming towards the state. So with that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what the bill accomplishes and the issues that we're seeing. And I think we can just go without the without technology. We've got plenty of examples, anyways.
Ms. Gordon, I think we have success here. Thank you.
That's okay.
While you're dealing with the technology, Representative Dabney, we have now achieved a quorum, and perhaps you'd like to move your bill for possible inclusion in the tax bill, and then we can add the amendment to get it into the shape that you'd like to present it.
Please, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the House File 3467 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and then I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. We did have an overview for those who came in later, the contents of the amendment. Are there any questions or discussions to the amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Sorry about the delay. So the first issue that we'd like to discuss and talk about is the issues presented by this category of products most commonly known as little cigars, and folks are going to pass around little baggies, and you can see that for all intents and purposes, little cigars act and are perceived by consumers to be cigarettes. They very closely mimic cigarettes in every way, shape, and form. They are very similar in shape and size. The packaging is similar. They often come in packs of 20. You can see that even the packaging is reminiscent of traditional cigars. Importantly, they're filtered. And so, you know, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it is oftentimes a duck. And they're often, importantly, also marketed very similarly to cigarettes. On the left is an advertisement for a Swisher Sweet menthol little cigar, and then on the other side is for Cool menthol cigars. And you can see it's very similar. It'd be hard to tell the difference in the messaging of these advertising. So it's very important that understand in the minds of consumers when they purchase these products, they're purchasing them to experience them, smoke them, very similar to cigarettes. The only difference in these products, as you see, is that there's a small amount of reconstituted tobacco pulp in the wrapping paper of little cigars that allows it to be excluded from Minnesota's outdated current definition of what a cigarette is. And that exclusion leads to kind of the heart of the problem in terms of these products being treated differently under current Minnesota laws, and particularly tax designations. You'll see on the left is a traditional pack of Camel cigarettes. We could all go out and probably buy them between $5 and $6 a pack. We all know that in every pack of Camel sold in the state collects $1.56 in taxes, and that's a combination of the excise tax, sales tax, and health impact fee. Little cigars, because they are classified as a tobacco product, are taxed at 70% of the wholesale price. And while that may seem to be equitable, in reality it's not, because the vast majority of the products that we see in the state are of the discount or deep discount variety. And so just for sake of numbers, I think the fiscal note says that the average wholesale price of little cigars is 83 cents, but just for even math, let's say they wholesale for a dollar, the tax then is now going to be 70 cents on a pack of little cigars compared to $1.56, which is half of what the tax collected on a pack of traditional cigarettes. And so while you've got cigarettes retailing for between $5 and $6, you can see in this picture, this is a pack of Remingtons. The final retail price on this is a picture that was taken in St. Paul at a convenience store, is $1.59. So the final retail price is simply 3 cents above what the tax is on a pack of cigarettes. So pretty significant difference. The fiscal note, or the Department of Revenue, kind of says the opportunity cost of this is just under $2 million a year, the fact that these products are allowed to be misclassified in the tax statute, because for all intents and purposes, they are cigarettes, and we think that they should be taxed as such. And just to read what the sign says, it pays homage, I guess, to President Obama's iconic campaign slogan and look, and it says, can we smoke for less? Yes, we can, for $1.59. So obviously that leads to a lot of concerns about the integrity of the revenue collection system. These products also, because they are not defined as cigarettes, do not have to be tax stamped, which leads to a higher potential of tax evasion, and we know that the Department of Revenue Special Taxes has listed this as a potential concern. From the public health perspective, we know that price is an incredibly important factor in terms of reducing or discouraging youth tobacco use, and then also helping those folks who may want to take the opportunity to quit, instead of substituting down into cheaper products, that they would actually quit. So it's a combination of an assault, I guess, on the integrity of the revenue system, but then also for public health perspective, the combination of extremely cheap products, wide availability, these are available statewide, and then these flavors you can see in some examples we'll be passing around. I would encourage folks to smell them. These little cigar products often come in flavors that are candy and fruit flavored, chocolate, vanilla, grape, peach, strawberry, watermelon. These are obviously attractive to kids, the coloring, the flavors. I think we'd all be hard pressed to imagine a middle-aged man, I guess, picking up a grape flavored cigarette type product. So the combination of a lot of revenue concerns and also public health concerns, what this bill does is it fixes that definition to include these products. I do want to be very clear, though, that we are not, with this legislation, attempting to classify the larger cigars or cigarillo products as cigarettes. We do not touch these products in this bill. The way that we have crafted the definition very carefully means that in order for a product to be considered a cigarette, not only does it have to look, appear, meet a lot of criteria to make it that it mimics cigarettes, it also has to be below the 4.5 pounds per thousand threshold. It cannot be wrapped in whole leaf tobacco or be without a filter. And in addition, with the A3 amendment, we added the word cigarillo into the tobacco products definition to add even further assurance that we are not capturing these products, which are clearly different than the little cigars, into the cigarette definitional change.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain to me why cigarillos were not included previously in the tax?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we really are, have the most concern about little cigars. These are the products that we are seeing on the marketplace that are, this pack is $1.19. These are the ones that are coming in the most kind of offensive candy flavors, I suppose. So this bill is really an attempt to address these products because we think that they are intentionally being marketed and positioned in the marketplace to be cigarettes, and so we want to make sure that they're treated. Cigarillos, we don't see that being as big of an issue, and so we didn't want to capture all products in this definitional change. Cigarillos are still taxed and regulated as a tobacco product. We're just not saying that they are acting like a cigarette.
Thank you. Are you done with your testimony? We can take move to questions now?
A couple of more pieces about the bill.
Thank you.
The second problem that this bill really seeks to address is the problem of the new and innovative tobacco products. And as I mentioned, our laws are kind of stuck in the 20th century, and these products have moved on, moved way beyond that. And so at this point, there's new products that are either on our market or coming to market that are not even contemplated by our current tobacco definitions or youth access laws. And the most prominent being this category of dissolvable tobacco products. These are finely milled tobacco that come in tic-tac mint-like form, strips that dissolve on your tongue, or sticks, and I think some are being passed around. Again, these are mild flavors. They can be purchased cheaply and are often perceived to be very tobacco candy-like, and they do deliver high doses of nicotine, so they're not without addiction risk. And other health risks. In your packets or in the handout, there's also a couple recent articles from the New York Times and MSNBC about how these products are obviously targeted at children, and that smokeless tobacco in general, these products were called out, are becoming, or were the second most frequent cause of kid poisonings in the U.S. So these products are not without danger, and we simply want to include them, expand our tobacco definition and youth access definition to prevent kids from having the ability to purchase them. If we do not go ahead and take this action, it's likely if they come to our market that they could be displayed next to the gum and candy, and there's nothing that would prevent someone from under 18 from purchasing them. They're obviously inexpensive, they're discreet. You can see as a parent myself or as an educator how this could be a problem in the classroom. It would be hard to track these because they don't have a smell on your breath. The other example is of an e-cigarette that is in Minnesota. This is really a product that came about with the widespread of smoke-free laws, and this is a product that mimics smoking. It uses a battery to heat a nicotine cartridge or nicotine-like substance and releases a vapor into the air. And again, we're not trying to ban these products. We're simply trying to prevent kids from having access to them. And the last piece of the youth access provisions that we're trying to modernize and update is making sure that all these products are put behind the shelf except for in tobacco stores that derive over 90% of their revenue from tobacco sales. So this is a picture from Southwest Minnesota, and as you can see, we've got several of the little cigars, also cigarillos, being displayed next to sugary kids cereals in a convenience store. So we simply want to make sure that all tobacco products are behind the counter to reduce the potential that kids can have access to purchasing them. And the final piece of the bill is, as I mentioned, cigarettes are the only products in the state that are required to carry tax stamp indicias. And so we would just simply like the Department of Revenue to look into how we can extend either tax stamping or some other system to all tobacco products, including rounds, large cigars, just so that the state can ensure that the taxes that are owed are being collected and reduce evasion. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Gordon. The creativity of the market is amazing. We do have a number of members who have questions. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is for Representative Dabney. If you can just give me a brief summary. I remember us dealing, felt to me like, extensively with cigars last session, and are we just setting that issue aside? I'm thinking from the testimony from the bill brief I've read that that's not a part, and I guess if that's not, I want to make that really clear for those who really cared about that last year.
Representative Dandy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reiner. This is unrelated. This really is about assuring that this new generation of tobacco product and tobacco-related products, such as these cigarettes, are covered under Minnesota law, and it does not go into some of the territory that we covered last year.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. First of all, I think the testifier said something like this is a housekeeping bill. I don't know if I misunderstood that or not, because I think this is a little more than housekeeping. But I'm really, a couple of things here. First of all, I don't think the kids are going to be able to get into these packages. How do you open these?
They'll help you.
Kids will get them open. Ask a kid. Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, how does this, if we passed all this stuff, How would this compare with other states? Of course, I'm, you know, I border Iowa, I border Wisconsin. Is there cigarette reciprocity, or what have we got going here?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I'm going to throw that to Ms. Gordon, who's much more knowledgeable.
Thank you, Ms. Gordon.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, members of the committee. Certainly on the little cigar issue, this is an issue that has risen in concern both at the national level and in several states. We know at the national level, for purposes of taxation, little cigars are to be considered cigarettes if they're 3 pounds or less per thousand. Iowa is the same, where they treat little cigars the same as cigarettes in terms of taxation. And we do know, I think it's 42 attorneys general at one point filed a complaint with the federal government that little cigars needed to be treated similarly to cigarettes. In Minnesota, attorney general did sign that petition. The difference in what we're doing with this bill is that we are raising the weight threshold to 4.5 pounds per thousand, because what we've seen is that manufacturers will manipulate their product weight or their packaging weight to get above the 3 pounds per thousand, just above the 3 pounds per thousand, in order to evade being considered a cigarette for tax purposes. So we think by setting the weight threshold at 4.5 pounds, we'll avoid some of that behavior, some of that manipulation, so in that sense, Minnesota will be a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of anticipating manufacturers trying to manipulate their products. The e-cigarette issue is certainly being visited by many states in terms of trying to keep them out of hands of children. And then I think a lot of other states, while we may be in a leadership position in terms of defining some of these products as tobacco products, a lot of other states are looking at these. I mean, these are certainly items of national concern.
Well, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, you used the word several times, manipulate. Maybe they're just complying with existing law.
Ms. Gordon, do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got it open.
Any other questions for Ms. Gordon?
That was a tough one.
Thank you. Are there other testifiers, Representative Dabney, you'd like to bring up?
I have no further testifiers, Madam Chair.
Are there any other people who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Please come forward and introduce yourself for the committee.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Madam Chair, is there a page that could pass the house?
Sure.
It's been manipulated.
Can I get one as well?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
They boil the water, you're smoking the air. You're smoking vapor.
Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the tape and then present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I am the Executive Director and Legal Counsel for the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, which is a trade association of tobacco wholesalers here in the state of Minnesota. House File 3467 raises several serious questions regarding the accuracy of the fiscal note that the Department of Revenue has prepared and the legality of applying the 35-cent non-settlement cigarette fee to little cigars under the bill. First, regarding the accuracy of the fiscal note, a chart is being passed out to you, and I'd like to take you through that to show you where revenue will be lost on certain little cigars and where it may be gained. In the marketplace today, there are approximately 200 different brands of little cigars. I've only highlighted five of them here. The first is Swisher Sweets. You saw those in the video. These are like a pack of cigarettes. However, they've been sold for decades. This is not a new product. If the tax is changed to $1.56 per pack versus the 70% OTP tax, the other tobacco products tax that is currently charged, the state, based on current wholesale cost and retail price, would lose approximately $6.70 per carton, because these are sold in cartons of 10. Or by individual packs. So 67 cents a pack, or $6.70 a carton, would be lost by the tax change. Second, there was an amendment to the bill which would exclude cigarillos. These are Swisher Sweet mini cigarillos. The definition of a cigarette has been changed to have three components. First, it has to weigh less than 4.5 pounds per 1,000 cigarettes. These weigh less than 4.5 pounds per 1,000 little cigars. Second, it has to be wrapped in whole tobacco leaf. This is not wrapped in whole tobacco leaf. It's wrapped in reconstituted paper, which is two-thirds tobacco, one-third paper. Thirdly, it has to also have a filter. This does not have a filter. So it meets all the requirements to be included as a cigarette and reclassified as a cigarette. I understand the amendment goes on to exclude those, but to us that's confusing. In one paragraph it says these are cigarettes, which would subject it to the stamping that my wholesalers have to do. We have to apply the cigarette tax stamp to each package. Our current cigarette machines don't stamp this size package. They're only calibrated to stamp this size package. We would not be able to stamp these. So if they're excluded, that's fine. The reason why they've probably been excluded is because, as you note in the chart I gave you, you lose $1.96 per pack in state tax. So it's just confusing to us whether these would be subject to the state tax as a cigarette and then subject to the stamping requirements, or they would not. Prime time, the third column there, is another little cigar. There, the state would lose $2.70 a carton. The proponents of the bill also highlighted Remington, and we agree if you reclassify those little cigars, Remington would add revenue to the state of $11.20 per carton. My sense is the sale volume of those would drop because the price would be so dramatically increased. And then they also highlighted Cheyennes, I believe, very similar, and those you would gain about $6.60. The purpose of this chart is simple. There are 200 brands of little cigar products out there. I didn't have time to go through all 200 to see what the revenue gain and loss was. We'd be glad to work with the department to do that. My wholesalers have all that information. But it's key to whether this bill would actually gain revenue for the state or potentially lose revenue. And it's a question I think we need to have answered. Also, please keep in mind that the current tax collection system for tobacco products in Minnesota is very efficient and very effective. There are approximately 35 active wholesalers in the state that collect and remit $427 million a year in cigarette taxes, tobacco taxes, and health impact fees. Turning for just 1 minute to applying the non-settlement cigarette fee. About 6 years ago, a bill was passed here in Minnesota that required those cigarette manufacturers that were not a part of the 1998 cigarette settlement with the state to pay a 35-cent fee per pack of cigarettes. As an attorney, I realize that a literal reading of that 35-cent fee statute would apply the 35-cent fee to these little cigars. However, just because the statute applies it doesn't mean it's constitutional. The Minnesota Supreme Court issued a ruling in 2006 on that very statute. And a part of the ruling stated that the statute does not create a selective classification because all cigarette manufacturers, whether you were a part of the original settlement or now subject to the fee, pay into the state. That's not the case with little cigars under the current bill here. Some will pay and others will not. They're all little cigars. And that creates a selective classification that may not withstand legal scrutiny. In short, we're confused about whether these are little cigars under the amendment or whether they're not. Do they have to be stamped or do they not? We're not sure about the revenue estimate, and we'd like to work with the department on that. And I suggest the legality of the statute is raised in question because it creates a classification of some pay and some don't. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reinert. Representative Reinert has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the testifier wants to speak to the other portion of the bill dealing with the sticks and orbs and strips and all the other things that we just had a chance to take a look at, which to me caused a lot of concern.
Mr. Reinert.
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert, we do not have any concerns about those provisions of the bill. My wholesalers have always assumed those products are tobacco products. We have been collecting and remitting the 70% tobacco product tax on those products. You're talking about the lozenges, the dissolvable tablets. We agree that should be in the bill.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, when you say that your wholesalers already consider these to be tobacco products, how are you as an association working with your wholesalers to prepare for the ones that haven't made it to the Minnesota market yet? I mean, are each individual wholesaler sort of staying up on current trends? Are you as an association working with them to highlight some of these products that haven't hit Minnesota yet? It's particularly concerning when clearly it's a tobacco product, and yet because we haven't caught up with, frankly, ingenuity, and ingenuity is good, but we still need to apply, I think, some of the same restrictions, especially with underage purchasing.
Mr. Reinert.
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert. When we receive these new products in our warehouses, my wholesalers determine them to be tobacco products because the labeling description of the ingredients says tobacco products. In fact, the little dissolvable tablets say it contains granulated tobacco. So we take that as a tobacco product, we tax it accordingly, and the manufacturers also have a field sales staff which works with our wholesalers to educate them about that, as well as to educate the retailers that these should not be sold to minors. We agree these kind of products or the new electronic cigarettes should not be sold to minors. Retailers shouldn't sell them, nor should minors be allowed to purchase them. So we don't have an issue with those kind of new products.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bryant, good morning. Welcome. Good to see you. Do you know if other states, we've talked about some that do include the little cigars, the cigarettes, how they have dealt with this? Because it sounds like there may be some confusion on the part of the wholesalers. And then the other question, you mentioned the stamping machines and the ability to use that on these different the size of packaging. How would wholesalers be able to address that? Would that be a significant expense? Or thank you. Mr. Bryant.
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative, a couple of things. In terms of trying to stamp these odd-sized packages, we'd have one or two alternatives. We either go back to what is called hand stamping, where an individual, one by one, applies a heat stamp to each package. That is extremely labor-intensive, and my wholesalers have told me they simply won't do that. These cigarette stamping machines we use are very high speed. They're very expensive machines, about $100,000 a piece. They can stamp a carton of cigarettes very rapidly. So we can't go back to the old technology of hand stamping. That means these products would probably not be sold in the state anymore, and you would not receive the revenue from those products anymore. We can't go back to hand stamping. Did that answer all your questions?
I think other than just the question about other states and how they've addressed that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. There are about 11 states, or 12, that have reclassified some little cigars as cigarettes. Those, of the 11 or 12, I believe there are 5 that require stamping, but they limit the stamping to just this product that's the same size and shape package. So that's how they've resolved that. And then they have non-stamping of the others. It just creates some confusion for the wholesale industry when that happens, because what is stamped and what is not, especially when you get into different packaging sizes. That's what we're concerned about, because I understand they're trying to eliminate mini cigarillos, but there are other little cigars that have a filter and would be reclassified as a cigarette. That's not the same size package. They're very small, and because of that, they won't fit through the stamping machine, which means we have to hand stamp or not sell the product here in the state. So 11 states have done it. 5 require stamping of this size, but they don't require the stamping of the other size packages because it can't be done. There's no machine that exists that'll do it.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made a comment about questioning the constitutionality of doing something. If 11 states have already done something like this, can you explain to me why you think that there's a constitutional issue here?
Madam Chair, Representative, I went back to the 2006 Minnesota Supreme Court decision that looked at the constitutionality of that statute and really looked at the standards that they applied to it. And that's what I'm basing my legal analysis on. I know the Department of Revenue has issued a memo that, yes, it's legal and that can be go forward. But I've talked with some of the little cigar manufacturers, and they indicated they would most likely bring legal action about that, and perhaps someone from the cigar industry can testify on that as well. But when you look at classifying the same product differently and setting up different standards, that is discriminatory in its application, and that's where the constitutional issue comes in, is treating things differently that are basically the same.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually know the answer to this question. I just graduated from law school and was just sworn into the bar, so I know the answer to this question.
Madam Chair, I think more importantly, I believe Representative Hilstrom is the state's newest attorney, having been sworn in on Monday.
Congratulations. Well, Representative Hilstrom, we look forward to learning now from your newly acquired knowledge.
Okay, well, when the legislature wants to classify things differently, it actually is not based on sex, or it's not based on any protected class here. And so when we treat them differently, we only have to have it be rationally related to a government purpose, a legitimate government purpose here. And you could argue that keeping these kinds of tobacco products away from kids would be a legitimate government purpose. And so I think it might pass the test. I won't swear to it, but I think it might.
Madam Chair, may I respond briefly? Representative, I understand the rational test, but the difference to classify these as a cigarette goes to weight, paper, and whether they have a filter. That's not a government purpose that's being fulfilled. It's a characteristic of the individual product. When the Supreme Court ruled in 2006 that the 35-cent fee was applicable to non-settling manufacturers, they did rule that the government had a rational reason to make sure kids don't get these cigarettes. But they were all cigarettes. They're all the same thing. Everyone's treated equally. Here, if you pass this bill, you're going to treat some little cigars based on the factors of weight, filter, and paper content, not whether kids can buy them, as to whether the 35-cent fee applies or not. That's the classification that brings in the legal question.
Representative Hilstrom, and then.
Madam Chair, so are you advocating that we add all the others to the bill? Because I could vote for that.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you do that, a number of the others cannot be sold in Minnesota because they can't be stamped with the cigarette tax stamp. You will lose state revenue because of that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davney.
Perhaps for the committee's edification, we could add Mr. Michael to this constitutional scrum we've got going. I don't know if he wants to explore. I know he's well familiar with the statute and related issues.
We always appreciate Mr. Michael's perspective.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the appropriate legal standard is the rational basis standard, as Representative Hilstrom indicated. And I think the court might look at this not so much as saying, well, what are the characteristics of the products, but it could conceivably, realistically look at it. And I think the advocates for this bill are trying to frame it in a way that would limit it to products that essentially look and are marketed like cigarettes, because this is trying to treat them like cigarettes. And if the court views the product differentiation as being meeting that sort of standard of saying, well, this is more like a cigarette than a cigar, that then it would very likely conclude there is a rational basis. And that's, I'm guessing that would be the focus of the analysis.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but a comment. I think I have to learn more about stamps and how that happens. And, you know, the idea of going back to hand stamping does seem, you know, crafty, but probably not necessary. But if an industry can create sticks and orbs and dissolvable strips, it seems like we should be able to figure out the stamping issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davnick.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for your comments. This is a pack of cigarettes, and I can pass it around. It's got the stamp on it. It's not the shape of a pack of cigarettes I ever bought in high school. is this my time?
16.
But, you know, so I don't know the full answer either, but clearly there's some ability to stamp oddly shaped carton or packages of cigarettes. And I think further, we would not want to base state revenues on the physical dimensions of the object being taxed. We're taxing tobacco products, not the shape and size of a box.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Bryant, one last comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, in response to Representative Davenies, the package that he's sending around now has the same height and depth. The cigarette tax stamp fits on there because of the depth and so forth. This package doesn't have the depth to apply the stamp that the state currently has. It would not adhere because the stamp is wider than the package. There are technical impossibilities to doing this. That's why the 70% other tobacco product tax system currently works well. It brings in a significant amount of revenue for the state without the technical difficulties of stamping these products. That's the way we look at this.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up to that point. So I just want to be clear. So you're saying that it would be physically impossible for a manufacturer to repackage that package you just held up so that it would be the same depth, height and depth? Sort of on Representative Murphy's point, an industry that's clever enough to come up with all these different products, it seems to me is clever enough to come up with, if they really want to sell the product in Minnesota, a package that would fit the specifications.
Madam Chair.
Impossible.
Representative Reiner. I don't intend to speak for the manufacturers how they might package their product. I represent the wholesaler, so I don't know if they would do that or two, would it be possible. This is a pack of six, and I don't know if they would do that. So.
Representative Broad, and then Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, I think the relevancy for me in this discussion related to the packaging is, I don't think anything is technologically impossible, so it can probably get done. But the facts are, or the questions I think that are relevant to what we have here today, are less about what can be done than what is assumed in the revenue estimate. And so I think that's what I'm hearing from one part of the testimony, is that the revenue estimate, if things remain equal today, and by the way, Madam Chair, I support the bill. I'm just trying to get the rationality here. But if you support, or if things are as they are today, with technological capabilities, with the stamping capabilities, we can't assume that they can transfer those capabilities like that. So if they are the way they are today, and it is a, quote, impossibility to create the stamping today, are the assumptions related to the fiscal ramifications right or wrong? Or close or not close? And so to me, that's the relevancy of the discussion related to stamping, is not whether we can or can't change the boxes or can or can't stamp the products in the future. It's, can we do that today? And if we can't, then are the changes or the assumptions accurate related to whether the products will be sold or not sold? Are we relying upon good figures on which to make our decisions and our revenue estimates? And so I guess that's the relevancy I see in regards to this discussion. It's less about technology and more about accurate numbers. Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, but then I have a question for the department. I just personally, with all respect, I just think this idea that, we can't find a way to do it is not the issue here. I remember when I was a kid, the tobacco industry said they'd go out of business if they couldn't advertise on TV. And they certainly didn't go out of business. And then when I was on the city council, Bloomington was one of the first cities to have the most strident youth access rules in the state, and that required IDing everything behind the counter. And we heard retailers pour into the Bloomington City Council chambers and said they'll all go out of business. Super America, everybody would go out of business if they had to comply to these youth access rules. And and everyone's doing fine. And, you know, so I think that some, you know, maybe this is a jobs bill for manufacturers. They can create a new machine. They can stamp these things. But, you know, I do want to ask, because I think that's really getting off, you know, the issue of the bill. I do want to ask if the chair would permit her, Ms. Cadoon, to comment about the governor's position as it relates to this legislation, or if the commissioner himself is here. You know, I did have a meeting with Commissioner Innes and Assistant Commissioner Cadoon on this bill, and I'll tell you that the concern was the revenue raiser in the bill. And so I've spoken with Representative Dabney about, you know, removing the revenue-raising part as the governor objecting to, you know, new revenue coming in and viewing this as youth access and a definitional bill. But I did want to hear if, you know, Ms. Cadoon could kind of inform the committee on, you know, it's here because it's got tax implications. But, you know, you know, what I heard in that meeting was that's sort of a non-starter for this year, for this governor, as far as bringing revenue into the omnibus tax bill. And so, you know, I actually asked Commissioner Innes in that meeting, can you think of a way we could get the revenue out? And I think Assistant Commissioner Cadoon can verify that. And I think Representative Dabney's got, you know, an amendment to do that. But maybe Ms. Cadoon could just get us back to, you know, why it's here and what the executive branch might be thinking about this legislation.
Ms. Cadoon, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Revenue. First address, Representative Lanchesky's question regarding the governor's office and the administration. Have not spoken to the governor's office directly on this or heard his position of support, opposition, neutrality on it. The conversation that we did have with Representative Lanchesky indicated that, you know, by the revenue estimate, as you can see, it is a revenue increase, therefore would be seen as a tax increase. The question of if he could support it or not, as you see other bills move forward, typically with the omnibus tax bill, it typically depends on kind of what the full package looks like, as if it would be an acceptable revenue that would likely need to be then offset by other tax decreases. I think that was the conversation that I recall that we had on this. If I could also just address a question regarding the revenue estimate. If you look, I believe you have the packet that does have the revenue analysis that was done by the department. And as Mr. Bryant indicated, he has concern regarding if it would actually be a revenue loss to the state. If you look in the bullet points, we tried to address some of those issues. We did, the department, the research division did do a survey of some of the PACs, did survey 12 brands of little cigars. They found in their survey that 10 brands were selling below this price of 2.73, and two brands were selling above that price. If you sell below it, the state will then gain revenue with changing the tax from the over other tobacco to the cigarette price. And if they're priced above it, as those two brands were, it actually then would be a revenue loss, as Mr. Bryan indicated. But as our research showed, there was a great substantial more of the brands being sold, or the little cigars were below that price. Therefore, that's why you're showing a revenue increase to the state. And there was also, in the bullet point, does show that there was they did factor in at least an elasticity factor regarding that there'd be some slight decrease in packs sold due to the increased product price. So that was also part of the revenue estimate.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Perhaps this is an appropriate time then for me to move another amendment, the one that Chair Lanchesky referred to. Pages could please distribute.
Thank you. Why don't you describe it as it's coming around?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to move the H3467DE1 amendment to be before the committee. Members, in summary, the DE1 amendment removes the little cigar language from the bill. It's good language. It's something that I hope we can continue to work on and arrive at a point where we can move forward, but that's not today. It also removes the request of the Department of Revenue to do a tobacco tax study to look at modernizing our tax system. It maintains the provisions modernizing the definition of tobacco and bringing tobacco-related devices, those e-cigarettes, under existing law. It maintains the prohibition of sale of tobacco products to minors and extends that to tobacco-related devices such as the e-cigarettes, including extending the requirement that they only be displayed behind counters and such alike. Includes tobacco-related products, including those containing lobelia, which is yet another weed that is used in these e-cigarettes. Under the prohibition of sale to minors, with all current penalties as for the sale of tobacco to minors, provides an exception for the prohibition of sale of tobacco-related products to anything licensed by the Food and Drug Administration as a smoking cessation or similar product. So the medical uses of these things would still be permissible and available for sale, and it maintains the retailer's affirmative defense for the sale of these products to minors.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Questions on the DE1 amendment? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just make a comment? I don't really have a question. This is a tough spot to vote on this because I don't want to take the other stuff out. I actually agree with it, and I know you do too, Representative Dabney, because you're carrying it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a difficult vote. I'm going to support it, but I would like all of the things you've brought forward to become law this year, and I think it's unfortunate that we're kind of left with a, do we sort of take a stand and get a veto, or do we get something done as it relates to these tobacco products? And I'll just say I met with the advocates a long time ago at a grocery store in my district. We met at there's a little cafe attached, and they kind of brought the kit, and they walked through all the Tic Tacs and the toothpicks and all that junk. And, I have to say I was really emotionally moved by that and thought, I was sort of horrified because I didn't really realize that that's what was going on out there. And those little breath tapes, that are actually tobacco. I think we need to do something. So I know it has the tax part here, and I think that puts us in a tough position. Those of us who, I'd raise the cigarette tax right now again if I could get that through. So I'm all for that, but I understand what you're doing here, and I appreciate that it's achieving a lot of the objectives of you and the advocates to actually try to get something signed this session. So I am going to support it, but it's a tough position to be in. So thank you.
Other comments? Representative Downing.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I share a lot of your sentiments, Representative Wencheski, and I'm curious, is there a revised fiscal note to match up with the DE1, or is the existing fiscal note still valid? I guess is one question. And then a second is, are we relying on these revenue estimates in our overall targets in ways and means?
Representative Dabney, do you want to address the first question?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, there is not a revised fiscal note, but the revised fiscal note would be zero. Hello? Perhaps I'm wrong.
Ms. Cadoon is bringing us some information.
Oh, will you look at that? There is a revised fiscal note, and it is zero. So I was batting 500. It's not as good as the twins, but I'll take it. Thank you, Ms. Cadoon.
Ms. Cadoon, we could only dream of such fast fiscal note responses at Human Services.
Exactly.
Representative Lubing.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have to, comment about this discussion about, the amendment and taking this out, Representative Dabney. I know you hate to do this, too. I really hate it. I think we're worshiping on the altar of no new taxes here. It's ridiculous to me. I understand. I of course, agree with you that it would be better to get this signed and get this under control than not to have it signed. However, personally, I think the governor should have to make this choice of, I don't think it's, going out and raising taxes on people and all that. That's not what this would be doing. But just to say, well, we can't raise any revenue, as Ms. Cadoon said, if it's raising some revenue, then it's not acceptable to the governor. I just think that's ridiculous, and I just need to put that on the record. I don't know if I, this is really a really tough choice because, I think it would be different for me if the governor wants to veto this bill with all that it does for kids in Minnesota, protecting their health because it raises a little revenue. I don't know. That's just, I just find, it's hard to find the words to describe how I feel about that.
Find them.
Any further comments? I'd just like to say, as the daughter of two people who died from the tobacco addiction that they acquired as children, I share Representative Liebling's sentiments totally. And I would hope that Ms. Gatun and others would explore with the governor whether there's openings that say that some things are more important than a fiscal policy stance. And with that, though, I will... Representative Dabney, would you like to make some concluding remarks before we act on your amendment?
No, Madam Chair, if we could move the amendment, and then I'd like to have just a moment before we move the bill.
Thank you. The DE1 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed nay?
No.
Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the bipartisan sentiment that's been expressed on the loss of elements of House File 3467 as it came to the committee. It is a difficult decision, and I want to thank those members who spoke up. I also want to thank the advocates who brought this bill to me, gave me the honor of carrying it, but then also stood back and decided, I think fundamentally, that keeping the next generation of tobacco products out of the next hands of the next generation of Minnesotans was a worthwhile goal and a significant accomplishment for this session. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to change the motion that is on the table. With the amendment of the DE1, inclusion of the DE1 amendment, there are no longer any tax provisions in this bill. And as such, I'd like to change the motion for House File 3467 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
And with that, we have that motion before us. Any further comments? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
Member.
You so much.
A minute ago. Where do we go?
Whatever.
Okay. Representative Solberg, are you ready with your bill? House File 3741.
Madam Chair, first of all, I guess I would move that House File 3441 be before us, and I think the Chair wants to have this as a possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Representative Sulford.
Unless
Sulford.
I can get it going by myself.
And the number is House File 3741, and it is now before the committee. We have an A1 amendment. Representative Solberg, would you want to offer that?
Before we do that, any amendments, let me give just a brief description of the bill. As many of us know, the state has a very difficult cash flow. Well, we've been trying to manage it working with the Department of Management and Budget. I think some of the things that we've passed in the law this year have helped them with 10, but quite frankly, 11 looks really bad. And this is an attempt to at least respond to the cash flows that we have. I would ask the Chair, if it's okay with Mr. Showalter, and I believe in your packet you have a PowerPoint presentation, and to explain kind of the need for this bill. The bill itself is changing some of the dates when payments are made to the state. And I know it's not without some controversy, but we are also hopefully trying to avoid us at any time having to go out to the market to borrow money. If we do that, I think there are some fallout type of things that could happen, like our bond rating may go down. So with your endurance, with your permission, I would ask Mr. Showalter to give us a...
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Showalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Before you, there's a brief PowerPoint presentation. Could I get some sense how much detail you want? I can do this very, very quickly. I just want to be sensitive to the time constraint.
Mr. Schollander, given that we appreciate your consideration, given that we have a number of bills, why don't you do the quicker overview, and we'll let questions clarify things.
Very good. Madam Chair, members, what you see here is just a brief overview of a topic that isn't often talked about and discussed in this committee, but I think it's an important one for the overarching financing of the state, and that is just cash flow. How do we keep the state's revenues in balance with our spending? Usually we talk about that as budget, balancing the budget, but really that's the whole year. At MMB, we really have to make sure that we have enough cash on hand to pay the bills that are going out in any given day. So what you start to get into is, well, when do local aids and payments go out? Local aids go out. Well, they go out twice a year in the first half of the year. When do school payments go out? Well, they go out throughout the course of the year, but they're front-loaded in the first half of the year. Then if you step back and think about, well, the revenue streams that you're more familiar with, well, what happens there? Well, income taxes obviously start to come in March, April, May, with some other payments throughout the course of the year. Sales tax still spread throughout the year. What you start to get the picture of is an imbalance on a daily basis of the inflows and the outflows of the state. Typically, that pattern is masked by large balances, either in reserves or just overall cash flow accounts within the state. The cash flow isn't really the nature of it. It's more like you have a number of different funds outside the general fund that usually have some balances. With the economy, with the budget solutions, that we are basically looking at that cash balance continuing to go down. What we're looking here is to make tune up some of the timing of our revenues so that they decrease the low points of the state. Just to give you a sense of the volatility, you'll see right here on the bottom of page one, just a cash snapshot as of April 13th. The statutory general fund had a total of $994 million in it. The general fund had $81 million in it. That was as of April 13th. Today, it has $940 million in it. But then again, today, we're also about to pay $395 million in K-12 payments. There's a fair amount of volatility here on a daily basis in the timing of our inflows and our outflows, and that's why we need to make sure we have adequate balances so we don't get caught short, so that a payroll doesn't not go, so the K-12 payments do not go, so that we are always able to make good on the obligations that the state is doing through its operations. The only way that we've been able to do that so far is interfund borrowing. You'll see in that bottom chart, we've taken $100 million from the Health Impact Fund, $385 from the Special Revenue Fund, and so on and so forth. The general fund is the source of the cash problem, and the only way we've been able to avoid external borrowing is really two things. One, borrowing from other funds, and there's only so far you can really go there. And then more recently, took unusual opportunity to use a statutory authority to hold back some payments, primarily to school districts, and that's the $501 million you see there. So the only reason that we had $81 million on April 13th is interfund borrowing and the fact that we are holding up some of our normally scheduled payments. That can't really be avoided and can't be fixed without some changes. The rest of the presentation really just gives you more detail, and I will just sort of refer you to the bottom of page 2. And that just gives you a picture of what we're expecting for the rest of this fiscal year, so that while we have currently a high cash balance as we start to pay back other funds, that balance is going to start to drop down. As we start to make those payments to school districts, the payment drop, the value of our general fund is going to start to drop. And as we look into fiscal year 11, that problem is going to only be more acute. So that is a quick summary, Madam Chair. That's the issue that we're trying to address with House File 3741.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I think it's important to look on page 5 of the and the subcommittee I serve on from Planning and Fiscal Policy has had 4 or 5 hearings on this. And I think if Mr. Showalter can kind of look at what the cash flow projections are in fiscal year 10 and the fiscal year 11, I think is important for us to understand the difficulty we're facing in the state. So if you would concentrate on those two charts.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members, as you see on the bottom of page 5, these are the February cash flow projections, the February forecast projections for fiscal year 2011. They don't include they include the roughly $1 billion deficit, so there's not a solution that's assumed in these numbers. But even with, you know, $1 billion of budget solution, you're going to see that we are on a cash basis in very low points throughout the course of the year. And that $1 billion solution isn't likely to all occur in the first day of the year. It's likely to be spread across the year. So we are going to see some of those cyclical imbalances and monthly imbalances where the payments go out early in the year, driving down our starting balance very quickly in August and September, to basically low points in September that you can't manage with a zero or a negative cash balance. You can't find ways to make payments when there's no money there. Now, we're thinking that a working capital figure of $500 million is an absolute minimum, and it probably should be higher than that. In order just to make sure that we've got some measure of ability and wherewithal to manage risk. Remember that also changes in collections, economic activity, payments, all of those things, all will impact what we really experience. But basically what we're seeing is very low or negative cash balances through much of the fiscal year. And we're going to need every tool we can get. That includes balancing the budget. That includes administrative changes that you could do just to try and make sure we're managing cash as closely as possible. But it also looks to make some statutory changes, as seen here in the committee today. Probably any other kind of tools that we can use to manage that cash flow throughout the course of the year. The last resort is external borrowing through a line of credit or some kind of debt instrument to the markets. That is done in other states, but it is, of course, just again another sense that a sign of the fiscal stress that the state is under.
And Madam Chair, if I may, particularly in the bottom of page 5, you will see the cash projections for fiscal year 11, and the ability for the administration, as I understand it, under current law, to borrow from the school, it is not available until September 1st yeah. of 2011, and you will see in that time of we're going into the negative for much of the year, and in some points it's close to $1.5 billion short on a daily basis. So if you borrow from all the other funds, it's really, really difficult to be able to make cash payments. So the bill that's before us is coming to you at the request of the administration, and it really has two or three components on it. One of the components is when the payments are made to the University of Minnesota, changing it by 5 days. Another one is to change the when the state remits the county the state's property tax, and then the third one is when the sales tax is remitted to the state. Whether this solves all the problems, I think, is an unknown, but at least I think that it does help to manage the cash flow at least on a daily basis. With that, there are a couple of amendments that have been requested, and before they're offered, I guess I want the committee to understand that there may be some people that want to express concerns about the bill in and of itself, because it may have some negative effect on the ability of the counties as well to have their cash flow. And businesses as well. There are a couple of amendments that will deal with at least some of the to help, I think, solve some of their concerns.
Mr. Stolberg, we have, Representative Stolberg, we have a number of people or questions. Should we take those before we get into the discussion of the amendments?
Why don't you do that? Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Solberg or Mr. Showalter, in this fiscal realignment, which is what it sounds like it really is related to our who pays us when and things like that, what is the, I was trying to look through your charts, and I was trying to understand the swing. You know, in one of the charts, it looks like it's $1 billion swing, mm-hmm. and in one of the charts, it looks like it's $2 billion in terms of the variability. On page 3 or 4, can you just tell me which it is and how big of a swing we're talking in generally?
Representative, or Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on the period you're looking at. On the bottom of page 2, we're only looking at a period basically from April to June, the end of June. So you're basically seeing the volatility that we're anticipating currently in the general fund. I think the more appropriate swing is probably looking at, on page 5, looking at the 2011 cash flows, sort of the projected, anticipated changes that we are going to be seeing, where you start at a balance at the beginning or at a high point of over $2 billion, dropping to a low point of about $1 billion in December, and exceeding that low point again in March and April, before the balances start to get basically move from about negative 500 to a high point of about $1.5 billion in the month of June. So what you're seeing here is a number of different things. Is that imbalance of the timing of payments. So a low point in a month could be driven as simply as having our statutorily and legally required payment into the debt service fund for all of our capital bonding projects, and that goes in probably around November 30th. That's around $500 million. But we don't get sales tax remittances. We don't get the statewide property tax until December, maybe only 4 days later, but that drives our cash balance to a low point in November and December. If we were able to make just a modest adjustment in the timing of those payments, like it's shown in this bill, you would see some of those low points being much less low.
And so, Madam Chair and Mr. Showalter, then the goal is not a, you know, we over time have done individual shifts from one biennial or one fiscal year to the next by 1 or 2 or 3 days. The goal is a structural realignment. Is that a fair characterization,
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's a fair characterization to the extent that it's understood that this is still a modest realignment of the payments and the revenues within the course of a year. It has no budget impact on an annual basis. It is really a net zero, and just looking at the payments within a month or within a series of months to make sure that we can get that intra-month low point improved.
And, Madam Chair, I would call your attention, just, if you just look at June 11, within that month, the very last chart and the very last one, again, Mr. Showalter kind of mentioned it, within the month, there may be a day when you are negative over a half a billion in the hole. With no money, and at the end, or at the high point, is 1.5 with an ending balance of 1.5. But within that month, there's a huge difficulty for them to manage their cash with the payments.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is for Mr. Showalter. You might have answered most of my question. So this somehow nets out to zero. So none of these shifts actually kind of roll over from one monthly period. It's all within a month. So it is a net zero. So we're not using these shifts somehow to balance our budget per se then.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, if I could follow up.
Representative Downey, I urge the whole committee, though, to realize that we're almost at noon and we've got a number of other things to get through, so we need to kind of move quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious what the, if there are any standards, are we getting way outside the norm? I was just looking at the days of between incurrence of sales tax liability and collections, and it feels like we're shortening it down maybe like an average of 45 days to a merchant down to 30 days. Is there any kind of standard for governmental entities, from just a fairness standpoint or even a legal standpoint in terms of what we're allowed to do, and are we within those guidelines with this move?
Representative Downey, I understand that Ms. Dalton may have some comments on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I did have some concerns with the retailers and some multi-state retailers, and of the 44 states who have sales taxes, 29 of them require remittances on our current due date of the 20th of the month. There's only 2 that actually require it earlier than that, which is what this bill is proposing, and the remaining 13 states actually require it at a later date.
Madam Chair, there are other questions. I'm sorry.
There are Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Showalter. Maybe it's properly to Representative Solberg, but I'm trying to recall, and I know we're talking about modifying these shifts in order to avoid the short-term borrowing, but remind me, and maybe I should remember this from the shutdown days of yore, but who's the left hole in the bag? Who gets paid first and last if we don't meet this? And by that, am I talking, you know, I'm talking payroll, who among our creditors get paid first and who doesn't in the event that we do have problems here without the short-term borrowing?
Well,
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I would answer that, and I don't know the full answer to your question. All I can say is that I think payroll would be paid, but the rebates that were due to businesses last fall were delayed 120 days. So maybe Mr. Showalter can answer the question a little bit better.
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I agree with Representative Solberg that, you know, it is unclear if we ran out of cash on a given day. Frankly, whatever payment is due that day is probably the one that's going to be the most impacted. If we ended up making our school aid payments 3 days prior to that, you know, that's already liquidated, and it's a matter of, what is the payment that's supposed to go out? Is it supposed to be payroll? Is it supposed to be vendor payments or something else? That is why, you know, really we would look at the department to make sure that we have some financing arrangements in place so that we don't get to that space. That usually is a economic and political and vendor problem that we don't want to pass on, and would try to make sure that we have as many tools as possible to avoid that. And really, it is depends entirely on the day that it happens.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I don't think this bill will necessarily say that we're going to avoid having to go out into the marketplace for a line of credit as well.
Representative Loon, and then I think we need to move to the amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be brief. Mr. Showalter, or to Representative Solberg, I'm just wondering, historically, if you look back a few budget cycles, can you comment on kind of, has this been a continually worsening problem? Obviously, in some years past, we've had budget reserves, and we have it now for a bit. If you could comment on that. And then with regards to a reserve, if you were to select a number that would be prudent given what we know now about the budget, and as much as we can project out, the picture does not seem terribly favorable in the immediate future, what would be a prudent amount in your opinion?
Well, let me try to answer the first one. That's
Solberg.
The very same question I asked in the subcommittee I serve on. And Mr. Showalter has given me this, and I'll get it duplicated for you. The fiscal year 81, we borrowed $6 million, 82, 34 million, 83, 80, I'm sorry, 82 was 34, 83 was 84, 84 was 26. We did not have to borrow any money from any of the other funds until 2003, which is $850 million. 04 is $200 million. 05, $525 million. 06, $450 million. 07, zero. 08, $125 million. 09, $950 million. And 10, $1.05 billion.
And so, thank you, Madam Chair. So, given what you have learned with that information and kind of where we're at now, what would be your recommendation for a budget reserve or an adequate cash flow to try to prevent us from having to borrow from our school districts? And
well, Madam Chair, that's always a subject. I suppose more is better in some respects. You know, if we were at the 357. $653 for the budget reserve and the $350 in the cash flow account, I think that we'd be able to manage that.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's go to the amendments. We have in our packet an A1. Is that what you'd like to start with?
Yes, I would like
with?
To offer that amendment. I think it's technical in some respects, and it helps, I believe, the retailers in in this example, as I understand it, the bill has a remittance on the 14th instead of the 20th of the previous month's sales, back 90% of the previous month. And some retailers maybe have a good month in December and an awful month in January. And so I think this refers back to, it gives them option to go back to the 90% of the month from the year ago. So I think that's what helps. Is that basically part of the question? I think that gives the retailers a little bit more flexibility.
Great. Representative Solberg moves the H3741A1 amendment. Any questions? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment is adopted.
Two amendments.
And we don't have that in our packet. If the pages could bring that.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, members, this is also at the request of some of the, I think, the retailers. As was stated before, you know, we'd be kind of out of line on the 14th as opposed to the 20th. And if and when we get through this difficulty, the Amendment A2 will put it back to the regular payment schedule of the 20th for the sales tax remittance. And I believe the administration is okay with that. It's kind of a sunset provision. It does not sunset, I don't think, the property tax payment, but it does sunset the sales tax payment.
Thank you. Representative Brunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Solberg. I'm just curious, I suppose I'll see the language here, but how does it talk about when we get through this mess? I mean, is there a definition? Or
yeah. Well, I think it's the definition of when the 350 and the cash flow account and the 653 is restored.
When that's paid back.
When that's paid back.
Does this then line up? So when those are paid back, this just disappears?
I believe that's the case. Yeah, 90 days. There was some discussion that maybe we should also have this until the school shift is paid back and the airport fund is paid back and other funds are paid back. But I think this, I want to worry about cash flow and not pay anything back, and so that this is deals with the cash flow account when it's remitted.
Just Representative Brown. Thank you. And Representative Solberg, I'm just curious, you know, we've been having the cash flow account whole and the rainy day fund whole, and then they've been not whole, and then they've been whole again, and then they've been not whole again. I'm just curious, does this trigger back on and off, or is once it's off, it's off?
I think the way it's drafted, I would assume it's when it's off, it's off.
Okay.
I would think that's the case.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I support the amendment. I think there's a legitimate concern here on this amendment. I think it's good to do this. But, you know, I do want to just to have everyone think about this for a minute. I mean, this is the governor's bill. Representative Solberg and Representative Carlson and I are carrying it for the governor. This is not our bill. And you know, Mr. Showalter knows that I think some of the changes in here are actually good reforms permanently. I think some of them are really bad ideas. This is a list of shifts and gimmicks. And this is because we are in a difficult situation. And so on the one hand, you know, I feel this is a very controversial bill because, on the one hand, there are a lot of other ways to deal with this cash flow problem. One is new revenue. And if we had more revenue, we wouldn't have a cash flow problem. Another is more government cuts. And the governor did not propose solving the deficit with all cuts. He proposed, I think, $600 or $700 million of cuts when the deficit was $1.2 billion, or new revenue. So you're sort of left with a list of bad options if you've boxed yourself into no revenue and you're not willing to cut more. And so that's kind of why this is really here. On the other hand, I think it's a good idea because it's helping Minnesotans. It's helping Minnesotans not have to have the ill effects of short-term borrowing that they ultimately pay the price for when there's a cash flow problem. And so it's a short-term, you know, fix because we're not really addressing the big problem. And then it's going to all come back, of course, in the future, because when you look at Mr. Showalter's charts, you're all going to fall off the cliff in 2011 if we don't either cut government significantly more or raise revenue or some of both. And I know the tax committee knows, you know, I've got the biggest cut bill out there for public consumption this year, $1.2 billion all in cuts. And folks can go rate it, and still no one wants to co-author that with me. But for folks, you know, this is, you know, it just needs to be clear on the record here. This is the governor's proposal. And I think we're in a tough situation with this. So, you know, I do support this amendment, but I'm interested to hear, you know, from minority members, honestly, and maybe new voices of minority members, because I think I know where most people, you know, where more vocal folks are. But, I would suggest that Representative Carlson and I and Representative Solberg and need to talk with the Speaker and Representative Zellers before we decide what we need to do, what we do with this bill today. You know, it could go on the omnibus tax bill. It could travel alone. Representative Solberg and I have talked about this, but it does seem that it shouldn't be, you know, a few Democrats getting this thing through for the governor. So, you know, I don't want to be partisan about it, but this is really not the ideology that the current majority has fostered. And, you know, I'm hoping Representative Zellers, who is a member of this committee, he's not here today, can give some insight as to the support of his caucus on this proposal. And so, you know, I'm going to vote for this amendment, but I think we should have a little discussion. We're meeting in taxes, I don't know, tomorrow or Monday, and think about, you know, the omnibus tax bill is not yet out, if this should be in there, should it travel on, or should we just not do it? Because I think there need to be broad-based support for owning these shifts and gimmicks because of the cash flow situation Minnesota's in. If, you know, I guess I've just said my piece. I'm frustrated with this, and I do know that the governor has, you know, asked the three of us to carry it. We're doing that, and I do want to help Minnesotans. So, you know, I'll support the amendment, but if Mr. Showalter could just comment on that. I think it is clear that there's some good reforms contained in here and some stuff that's not so good. And I think this amendment is addressing that, and Representative Broad mentioned it with the retailers as well. So if Mr. Showalter would just be willing to comment on my comments, I'd appreciate it.
Deputy Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, a lot of good points. I agree with the overarching point here, that this is not a simple bill. It is that there is some controversy here. There is some change in practices, and that really it is a question of, for the legislature as a whole, as to how much flexibility is expected, or how much, how many tools we want to put into the tool chest to manage cash flow. The change in the property tax collection date has some impact on counties, although, you know, it is also clear that the statewide property tax is able to go to school districts at an earlier date than the state is receiving it. So I think there's a reasonable discussion there around what's the proper date for the state to receive those dollars. The sales tax collection is, in moving that date, is obviously a change in practice. It's a real policy issue for this tax committee and for the state generally. And I appreciate the consideration of the business community and legislators to think about this, but it is certainly a difference in practice than you see in most states right now. The last element of this, the change in date of the payments to higher education institutions, relatively minor, I think, issue, and it frankly follows some of the practices we've already worked out with those institutions. But there's some real policy issues here, and I appreciate the Chair's candor in raising them.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lynchesky.
If I may just correct myself, and Ms. Carlson-Walroth rightfully pointed out, Representative Biskins is now a co-author of my bill. So if anyone would like to join the Lynchesky-Biskins bill, it's available for co-authors. So, sorry about that, Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Lynchesky hit the nail right on the head, and Representative Carlson and Senator Pogemiller have co-chaired the subcommittee from the fiscal planning. And I think we've had four hearings on cash flow and how we manage it. And let me restate the fact that this may not prevent us from having to go out into the market and borrow money. We've had discussions on what type of best instruments would be best for the state to have. Got some recommendations from MMB on that. Whether it be a line of credit. Keep in mind that the borrowing that the state has already done from other funds also brings with it some costs, because those funds that would normally be getting interest, we're paying interest on it. Not all funds do that, but some of them do. We have to realize also that the availability for the large amount from MNSCU was because students made a payment of tuition. And so they had a bunch of cash on hand. I mean, that's one-time money that has to be paid back by the end of the year. So, I mean, they've managed the cash flow so far, but as you look at this chart that went out, we need to make some basic different types of direction for the state, period. Because this is unsustainable to keep using one-time money. That would kick the can down the road, kick the can down the road, kick the can down the road.
Representative Downey, is your question to the amendment? Otherwise, I think we should adopt that.
That's not the amendment.
Okay, the A2 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay? Amendment is adopted. Thank you. Representative Downey, briefly, because we do have a number of other bills.
Madam Chair, thank you. I won't go into all the details. I know the governor's supplemental budget actually replenished our cash reserves, I think, to the tune of $200 million. I don't think those are the targets we're operating under with the current numbers I've seen from Ways and Means. So I think to imply that the administration has somehow been negligent in trying to address this as compared to the legislature, which actually controls the appropriations, which are the real fundamental underlying problem here of our structural deficit. And members, I'm going to vote no on this. I think at some point in time, this legislature, in this two-year cycle, has to put its foot down and say, we're done with the shifts, we're done with playing games. This isn't about saving the taxpayers of Minnesota. Frankly, the taxpayers of Minnesota are all going to pay this. This is coming right out of the cash reserves and the cash flow of every business and every organization we're borrowing from. So to think that somehow the taxpayers benefit, now we've just moved the shelves from one taxpayer pool to another. So I'm voting no. Let's put our foot down as a legislature and let's find a way to do some structural reforms before we get out of here and end the shifts and gimmicks.
We just copied you guys.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Downey, welcome to the legislature. That's what we've been doing the whole time we've been here, the whole time I've been here. We're just pushing the money off onto a different taxpayer. That's what no new taxes is.
She's right. You're on.
Representative Reinhart, and then I think we're going to wrap this one up.
Madam Chair,
this is an important issue. Unfortunately, we have a large agenda here. This one we will be laying over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to clarify a point for either Chair Solberg or Mr. Showalter. I just heard the comment made that the administration didn't do shifts, and that's not what I understood from serving on four finance committees. Could someone clarify that for me if indeed that's not true?
Well, Representative Solberg.
I think the shifts in the use of one-time money to solve problems has been historically well-documented from the use of the tobacco settlement early on when there was a problem of $3 billion? $2 billion? $4 billion. One-time money and said, well, let somebody else solve it down. All those type of things, we've had, everybody's been in charge, both sides of the political aisle, been in charge to make those big reforms. And I was here when we used the tobacco money and the endowment and said, well, we'll just use that for ongoing expenses. I was here when we had big commitments for school payments and transit payments, but we said we'll just don't have to worry about the income part of it because the growth in the economy, everything will be rosy. And it wasn't, and it comes home to roost. I'm not happy to carry this bill because I think it shows exactly why we have a problem. And all you have to do is look at the chart. see when we didn't have to do this type of thing and when we have had to do it. You can make your own judgments on that. But everybody is at fault. There isn't anybody that's not at fault. And we all need to have a solution. And this is part of a solution. And I'm willing to step up to the plate to help the administration with the solution, a partial.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association and also the Midwest Hardware Association. For the record, I want to first of all begin by thanking Representative Solberg by working with us to try to make this proposal less painful. And I also want to acknowledge Ms. Dalton from House Research for doing the same. This bill that's now before you and the amendment that was adopted does make this proposal better. Certainly, I understand the context in which this is being drafted because the state's in a difficult bind in cash flow, but then so are retailers. I'd like to remind the committee that retailers collect and remit the sales tax free of charge, unlike many other states that actually pay retailers at administrative cost. And a national study that was done by government and business combined said a weighted average cost of collecting the sales tax is 3.09%. So this proposal actually is going to increase our cost without any additional administrative benefit other than to the state. And it's also probably going to increase the likelihood of errors. I want to say also that a version of this was actually tried in a couple of other states and then was cast aside because it turned out to be too costly for the state, too costly for retailers, and became overly burdensome on everybody's part. So I will tell you lastly that a proposal was floated to me last night that we could maybe use to simplify this a little bit even more, go back to one payment. I haven't had a chance to clear it with my members or any other associations, but I do hope that Representative Solberg will be willing to, and the chair would keep an open mind so that we could entertain something that might make this even less painful.
Representative Solberg.
I was unaware of that. I will always work with them, but they also have to work with the administration too to see if, because all the amendments I said I would offer, but they have to make sure that they're clearing with them as well. Okay?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And I know that you're probably laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Okay.
Or reconsideration at some other later date.
As amended, we will lay it on the table for future consideration and disposition.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. The next bill we'll take up is House File 3764, Representative Hosh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'll try to make this quick. I don't have any testifiers with me today, and I'll explain why shortly. House File 3764.
Representative Hosh, since you're not a member of the committee, would Representative Rukavina move House File 3764 before the committee for possible inclusion? And would you like us to act on your amendment? Just to get into the shape you want, or would you like to brief us on the bill first?
We can do the amendment, and I'll address the bill as amended.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina moves the H3764A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 3764 comes from an issue of a business in my district that approached myself and my senator, Senator Fischbach, about their Job Z status. This business entered into a Job Z agreement in 2004 with Deed. Since that time, part of the agreement of that Job Z agreement was to increase jobs by 38 jobs a year and to do a $5 million investment into their business. Since that time, 595 jobs were created. There are actually 350 jobs over their commitment that was done on the Jobs E agreement. However, in 2009, with the economic slowdown, recession, they did not meet the goals of that agreement. They have already on track in 2010 to meet that goal. Not only are they on track, but they've already met it. What we're looking for right now is for an ability for the commissioner that may allow for a business to be waived in 2009 of their job goal, job goals within the Jobs E agreement, as long as they met the goals in 2008. So it's permissive. This is important for many businesses throughout the state. The fiscal notes indicates anywhere between 40 and 50 businesses may be affected by this. But most importantly for the business in my district, when they entered into an agreement, the commissioner did have the ability to do this very thing. And it was waived, it was changed as a result of the legislative auditor's report. And they would just like to have the recognition that they've met the general goals of Jobs E and have exceeded them over its entire term, and want to continue to be participating in Jobs E and meeting the goals, with the exception of 2009. The bill is funded through REIT, which I understand this committee has addressed several times, and also the tobacco modernization, which I understand the committee had an extensive discussion on today. So I appreciate the time of the committee and happy to take any questions.
Representative Reiner. Excuse me, Representative Hunt.
That's okay, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, you just hit it, Representative Hosh. I just want to make sure people understood how it was being paid for through the increases, through the cigarette discussion that we just had, the tax increases that the governor suggested that he would not sign. Are being used to fund it. I just want to make sure that everybody was clear on and make sure that my understanding of the amendment was actually true also.
And
Representative Hosh.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, that is what I propose at this time. And one of the reasons is because it just felt like it made sense to follow up the discussion from earlier today. If there's problems with the governor, I'm happy to consider other ways to address the situation. I'm sure Senator Fischbach in the Senate would be happy to enter in those discussions also.
Representative Reiner.
Is there a follow-up?
I'm sorry.
No, that's
a
question. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hosh, I like the way you introduced the bill and then I read, or explained the bill and then I read the language, and I'm just wondering, to me a key component is that statement you made about tracking again in 2010. I don't see, and I offer an oral amendment, but I'm not finding the words quickly, but how would you address that? Is that just sort of instruction to the commissioner? I mean, I think the 08, 09 we can understand, but then we're back on track again in 2010 to me would be a critical component in wanting to make that extension.
Representative Hosh.
Madam Chair, Representative Reiner, I completely agree with you. I would be happy to find some language to say as long as they continue to meet their goals in 2010 and preceding years, that we add that in there. This business has already met the goals for 2010. It was just that 1 year from the recession. And we want to recognize the extreme economic challenges that many people faced.
Great. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will lay over the bill for a possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Dill, House File 3233.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 3233 to get it before us for consideration.
So moved. And I have a DE1 amendment. Is that your amendment?
That is correct. I'd like to adopt the amendment to the bill. I will get the bill in the shape that I need it in.
Representative Dill has moved the H3233 DE1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you. And the bill is adopted, Madam Chair. it repositions where sales tax is applied at the point of sale. Right now, if a paint and supplies, as defined, by the way, in the amendment, and in literature that comes from the Department of Revenue previous to this bill, defines that when people buy paint and supplies used in a repair of an automobile, a person who does the repair, your local body shop, they pay sales tax on it when they purchase it. And then when they do an estimate for the repair, which virtually everything is done by estimate, and they use the modern computer systems that generate these estimates, there is no place for them to recoup the sales tax on the items that they've already previously paid sales tax on, even though they are using them in the actual retail repair of a motor vehicle. And so what the bill does is, number one, it defines what is taxable, meaning the paint and supplies. It also defines where the sales tax is then applied, rather than when the purchaser or when the body shop buys it, that it is taxed at the retail level. That is the bill. It is a revenue raiser, and full disclosure, it raises a bit over $2 million in 11 and a small amounts thereafter. And the reason for the raise is, even though we're not increasing the sales tax, is because there's a markup on the paint and supplies between the time that it's bought at the wholesale level and it's sold at the retail level. Now, when estimates are done, they are generally calculated, say that a repair takes 10 hours to accomplish. There is a factor, sometimes expressed in number of hours, that calculates the number of, or the amount of paint and supplies. So on an invoice or an estimate, you wouldn't see one spray can of yellow and two rolls of tape and, you know, 1 ounce of oil. You would see 10 hours times a multiplier, which would extend out to an amount. And that's where the tax would be applied, on the extended amount. And that's also provided for in the bill.
Great. Questions? No? And to Representative Rubina.
So, Representative Hill, currently there's a formula, and that's how they calculate the sales tax, right? Do they pay it right when they buy the supplies?
Currently, when they buy, Madam Chair, Representative Rubina, when they buy the supplies, when your local body shop buys it, they are assessed the sales tax at that point.
But then, with the paint markup and the other markups that you said are in that, in the charge to the customer, include the fact that they had to cover the cost of the sales tax and that markup for the paint?
Representative Jill.
Madam Chair, Representative Rubina.
Twice, I know you're a good business man. Are you charging them twice then?
There's no reflection in the computer software. There's three or four different types of software that are used. And this is basically driven by the insurance companies, that they will accept the estimates from this software. And there's no place in the formulas to recoup the sales tax.
Senator Dammer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something I'm familiar with. I was in the auto parts business for 21 years, and to answer your question, Representative Rukavina, these are considered consumables for the business. So when we would sell supplies, rags, you know, carb cleaner, that sort of thing, you charge sales tax to the repair shop at the time they purchase it, because it's a consumable, not something they're rebilling to the customer. It is a source of confusion, especially with body shop. What's a consumable versus what's something that's included in their bid that they're charging sales tax on? So it is a bit of a question mark. I believe I didn't know about the fiscal impact. I'm not too thrilled about increasing the cost to my car if I go get it fixed by having to pay more sales tax. I can tell you from a business standpoint, it's much cleaner with Representative Dill's bill here, because it is a constant source of struggle, you know, myself as the business owner trying to get my, and I had three locations with multiple counter people trying to know if they're charging sales tax properly or not. I was probably the kind of guy, I probably shouldn't be saying this, I don't know if my statute of limitations is done, I'm the kind of guy that the compliance people would look for, because they would have to find out, and I don't know if my guys are charging it properly or not. If they would be billing to a body shop, were they charging sales tax, or were they doing it as resale? And some body shops resold some of this stuff, so sometimes it's resale. Sometimes they used it themselves, and it's supposed to not be resale. So this is one of those things that's really a confusion. I'm a little disappointed to see the fiscal impacts. I'm not too crazy about voting for this increased sales tax, but I do like the idea that it cleans it up. And it just says that they can put a little thing on their bill that says consumables will, you know, X number of cents, and we'll charge you some sales tax on that, so that when we sell to a body shop, we know that we can do it as a resale item, and you don't have to decide when to charge sales tax and when not. So it does clean that up. Representative Dill, I believe that kind of sums up what you're trying to do. Isn't that correct?
Representative Dill.
Madam Chair, that is correct, Representative Demmer. And if you look in section 2, it also talks about specifically in the language things that are not considered supplies. So not everything that would be, in my estimation, consumable is considered as a supply. And some examples of that would be that are not considered as a supply are things like floor dry or shop cleaning materials or compounds or rags or those types of things. We're talking about the paint, the tape, body putty, body filler, sanding paper, sanding discs, clear coat material, those types of things that are specifically used and remain on the vehicle or were used to get the vehicle into the point of appearance that it is when the customer receives it, to have the sales tax applied to that.
Great. Seeing no further questions, do you have a witness that you would like to testify? Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against the bill?
Well, I think he's indicated that the member of the tax committee has done such an excellent job in explaining the bill that he doesn't need to say anything.
We appreciate it. All in favor of laying over, we don't have to vote on this because we did adopt the amendment. We will lay over House File 3233 for possible inclusion, and thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 3805 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much for bringing the bill before us, Representative Liebling.
And Madam Chair, I also have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, and what this does is just it moves the effective date, and that was suggested to me by staff because it just I think makes it easier to. Ms. Dalton could just.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, streamlined sales tax requires a 30-day notification before a change and strongly recommends all changes start at the first day of a calendar quarter.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
So, Madam Chair, I would move the A1 amendment for that purpose.
The H3805 A1 amendment has been moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Amendment is adopted. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is kind of goes right in after Representative Dill's bill. It's a similar issue, but it is different in some very important ways. This is an issue, again, arising from our very complicated sales tax formula, the way we do sales tax, what gets exempted, what doesn't get exempted. In this bill, we're dealing with companies that sell durable medical equipment, some of which gets a sales tax and some doesn't. But the difference, really, from what we were just talking about with Representative Dill's bill is that in this case, a lot of this equipment is paid for by third-party payers, Medicare, Medicaid. And those payers, from what I was understanding from Representative Dill's bill, the car, repair businesses, you know, they have a problem, he was saying, because it's not programmed into their computers to account for this and so on. These folks that are with me today have an even bigger problem because they're dealing with payers who simply have a fixed payment schedule and will not pay any more for the sales tax. So what ends up happening is that these businesses don't have a retail customer, as we usually think of it, who can be asked to pay the sales tax. The sales tax is a liability placed on them, and they have no way to get that paid, by, so it comes off of their bottom line. What we're dealing with here are lots of, well, businesses of all sizes, I think, but certainly a lot of them are small, durable equipment businesses, small businesses that are, especially in these times, are really put at some severe financial risk. Many of them are rural businesses. We're going to hear a little bit about that. And so this is really creating a problem. A lot of times we're talking about what can we do to help our small businesses. This is something that I think it sounds to me like we really need to do to help our small businesses in the state. So I have with me Jackie Anderson, who is CEO of a durable medical equipment company by the name of Key Medical, and she's going to talk a little bit more about the problem and the potential solution that we proposed here.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you very much. As Representative Liebler said, I'm Jackie Anderson. I own Key Medical Supply in Shoreview. I've owned it for 12 years. I've been in the medical supply and equipment business since 1980, working for big companies and representing small companies as well. Today, I'm not only coming here on my behalf, but also for my trade organization, Minnesota Association for Medical Equipment Suppliers. And we have, as has been stated, been dealing with the last 2 years cost increases because of the oil price increases. Most of our supply items are derivatives of oil. We've also been dealing that time with reductions. And so in the last 2 years, we've estimated that there have been about 110 jobs lost just because of that. With the change in the status of the taxability of the items that we sell, we're estimating that when this starts being felt by the membership through audits, that we're looking at almost 300 job losses there. And we're talking about payroll in the neighborhood of $12.5 million for the jobs that have been lost already, and with the sales tax impact, another $9 to $12 million impact there. So it's a very serious issue. Most of our membership is small. We have about 55 paid membership. We estimate that there are about 100 companies, we used 75 in our background piece, that are in this full time. We have probably another 125 or so that are occasional billers. Those are the pharmacies that bill occasionally. For items. We also have some doctor's offices that bill occasionally for items. And so that makes the number higher, but we've factored all of that out. So the impact is very severe. There is not the shifting that we can do, as Representative Liebler said, because we deal with third-party payers. There is no mechanism for us currently to get paid for that tax. Historically in Minnesota, these items have not been taxed, and so they're not part of our contract fee schedules. So with the addition or the change of these items to taxable status, we have to have a mechanism to pass that along, and there isn't one. We're looking at some members that deal with more of the disposable supply items that go with these DME issues or items. In the neighborhood of $300,000 to $500,000 impact per year. There just isn't the margin there for that. So we're looking at these job losses as the only way to stay even. And then when you look going forward, the discussions with our own state revenue people here or the bill that talked about that, that's the same thing that we go through on a much smaller scale, of course, is balancing the costs of the business with what the revenue is coming in. So it's a serious issue. Again, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be something that happens as businesses wake up to this issue. We've already noticed in the outstate areas, particularly northern Minnesota and the southern part as you go past the Faribault and Owatonna area, that the number of suppliers are dropping off. We have been asked increasingly, we service the entire state, and we've been asked increasingly to go to these outlying areas in the north and the south to service patients. And we're talking about critically ill patients here. These are not convenience items. These are items that are prescribed by doctors and in most cases are life support.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Representative Brock.
Thank you, and Ms. Anderson, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm sensitive to the issues that you bring to the table. They actually kind of blend with a lot of what we've been talking about around here is that when you increase taxes on businesses who aren't able to, whether it's because they're dealing with third-party payers or because the market just won't bear
right.
the additional cost, that businesses then have to turn around and make job decisions
right.
On the ground. And when you have increased taxes, whether it's on a medical device tax or by bringing your industry into a new classification, those things matter. And so I really do understand and appreciate you bringing your specific situation forward, because I think we need to hear more about how what we do in government hits the ground both intentionally mm-hmm. and unintentionally. I'm sensitive to the reclassification. My question then is more for Representative Liebling. I'm just as we take one set out and put one set in terms of the tax realignment. That word's been used a few times today. But what now are we going to be considering for taxes versus where we're at today?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Broad, obviously the bill is structured to try to remain as close to revenue neutral as possible, and that's why as we suggest removing tax on some items, we're shifting it to other items. It seems to make more sense if we're going to tax some durable medical goods to tax ones that are a little bit more on the optional side. What we're taxing right now and what's creating a problem are the ones that are prescription and that are these really essential kinds of things. And I do want to just say, too, that this isn't I appreciated your comment. I think that's close to where we're maybe coming at this from a little different perspective. You know, obviously, sales taxes are supposed to be paid by the consumer, by the purchaser of the goods, and the businesses retain that and turn it over to the state kind of as an agent of the state. And in this case, they're not able to collect it. That's really the problem. It's not supposed to be a tax on the business itself. And yet in this case, it is, because they really have absolutely no mechanism to collect that tax. And I think that's a little, perhaps unique, or maybe there are others similar, but probably not too many, that it's that situation. But it is an unintended consequence, I believe. So we're talking here some of the things I asked before for a list of some of the things that are being taxed now that would not be taxed under the bill. And we've got some things like the alternating pressure pads, you know, when you're bedridden and you've got it attached to a machine and you've got a pad that fills and empties to keep you from getting sores, bed sores. Those are taxed currently. That would not be taxed. So those are the kinds of things that our testifier's company would supply. Or, for example, needles and syringes, other than those used for diabetes conditions, needles and syringes that are used for homebound people are, you know, that are necessary. They're prescribed by the physician. We're taxing those. Whereas we're not taxing small items that you would buy in a pharmacy, such as those nasal strips, a thermometer wouldn't be taxed?
Thermometers. Over-the-counter orthotics. I have some right now in my shoes. Dr. Scholl's. Those things that you buy as a convenience item would be taxable. However, our bill also, if the doctor does prescribe those to the patient, that would exempt that over-the-counter sale. So we have taken that into account.
So, Madam Chair, if I can just real briefly. So it just seems to me that, you know, if we can't just get rid of the tax because of our financial situation, so it seems to me to be more fair to move it to those small consumer items that really are discretionary, so that, and where the retailer collecting that tax can turn it over. You know, you go to Target, if you're going to buy the inserts for your shoes, clearly Target is, they're already collecting taxes on some items. They're able to do that, too. And I frankly think that, you know, although we're shifting it to other consumers, obviously, I think it's people are used to paying sales taxes on some items when they go to the store. And, you know, I don't think it would probably be an enormous burden on those people who would be buying those new items.
Thank you. Is there anyone who'd like, else who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will lay over this bill for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. The last item on our agenda is an update from the Department of Human Services on their maintenance of effort work. And while they're coming down, I will extend the committee's apologies that you've had to be here two full days listening to a lot of tax policy. And we're glad that we're able to get you yet up front today.
Madam Chair,
and there's a big handout in your packet. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you introduce yourselves and tell us where we're at.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm operations and budget manager for the Children and Family Services, part of the Department of Human Services. With me is John Zakel, who is my counterpart in the chemical and mental health area of the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chuck Johnson, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services, had been here for a while but had to leave because of a conflict. And he was going to tee this presentation up. So in his absence, I'll do the teeing. If you remember back at the end of February, we came in and gave you a presentation related to the reform of the funding of local government services in human services. We presented some background information from our cost studies that we do every year with the counties, and looked at various items like how much counties spent on various types of services, and one of the focuses that we had was just to show how variable the county share was across all counties in human services, especially social services. We were given the task of coming up with a design for redoing the state-local relationship. We basically scratched the surface of that pointed out some issues. We looked overall across all human services and all mandated human services. The committee had specified more that we look at the match and MOE part, the match and maintenance of effort part of the human services relationship. At the end of the hearing, we basically were committed to come back with some more data that may be more usable by the committee in coming up with some recommendations, and we were scheduled to meet maybe a month later and talk about what we had developed. In the meantime, we met with the counties, and we had met with the counties beforehand to look at various more concrete options that we might have for moving forward. And then after we had a meeting with Representative Loeffler and also on the phone, Representative Liebling risked her life to listen to our discussion with Representative Loeffler, and she was driving at the time, and we didn't present anything shocking, I hope. Where we landed was to provide more of a summary of something that we would call what the local share would be
in the various social services programs and provide that by county, and that's the document labeled county share calculation, and it shows it for five different social services areas. It once again shows that there's plenty of variation across counties. I think the other thing that it shows is that many times the variation in county share is because of how the counties are using federal match and the programs that they are using that are providing federal match. Most state programs don't have, at least in this area, don't have a match component, but either have an MOE or something of the such like an MOE. So this is a document that probably is more helpful for staff to look at, but it was useful to prepare just because I gained an understanding of how much the usage of federal funds creates a variation in from county to county. Then we've got the three other pieces that we included with that. We looked at three areas where there were definite maintenance of efforts or match requirements that did create variation amongst counties. The first one I wanted to call your attention to is the basic sliding fee maintenance of effort, which is a maintenance of effort that's quite varied across counties. We did a piece on that and just reviewed a little bit of the history, which all of these maintenance of efforts are basically historical artifacts of when something happened. In the case of basic sliding fee, it was 1996 that we pulled things together, did financing a little differently, and as a result, some counties had higher and some lower maintenance of efforts that just has moved forward. So we presented that. We have a couple of different looks at how the maintenance of effort is distributed. For your information, Representative Loeffler, I think working with Ms. Dalton, came up with kind of a hybrid approach, which is in the Health and Human Services bill now, which narrows the differential in maintenance of efforts from what was a kind of a 0 to 13% to now a little over 1% to a 6% of a county's allocation. So that's a narrowing that happened. Then Mr. Zickel, in the area of chemical dependency, will talk a little bit about that maintenance of effort and match that we analyzed and provided some options to Representative Loeffler on in terms of improvements there. And then I'll pass it on to him right now.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Zockel from DHS Chemical and Mental Health Services. I'll speak from two handouts that should be in your packet. The first one is labeled County Funding for Chemical Dependency Services. This was a piece that we provided to Representative Loeffler soon after the last hearing. Give you a little bit of a background. The maintenance of effort and match provisions in the Chemical Dependency Fund, the statute essentially has been unchanged since 1986. The way it works is that all counties pay at least a 15% county share, and then depending on how much counties were paying for these services in 1986, there's an additional county share, which works kind of like the Medicare donut hole, where they have to pay 100% for a while, but it's a different level for every county. And so it applies to some counties and it does not to some, and it changes over the years. The policy rationale for this structure had a lot to do with the fact that back in 1986, the Chemical Dependency Fund also covered non-entitled populations. Now, that stopped about 6 years ago, so most of the policy rationale hasn't been there for a while. So I'm really pleased that we were able to work with Representative Loeffler to figure out a way to just repeal this one. And what we did, you can see the proposal in the attached county-by-county charts. We eliminate that extra county contribution that some counties have to pay, and to make it budget neutral, we have the share for all counties increased from 15 to 16.14%. So there are some counties that pay about one percentage point more. I have talked with some of those counties. The ones I have talked with concluded that it was worth it to pay that point more in order to get rid of this complication. So I congratulate Representative Loeffler in getting this included in the Human Service Omnibus Bill. I think it's a great achievement, and I hope it's going to pass.
Thank you, Mr. Zakel. I can say that 4 years ago, I cared for the counties, a 15-year phase-out of this most hated maintenance of effort, and wasn't successful in getting it through because it cost money. Even on a 15-year phase-out, since that time, because of the chilling effect of budget cuts and changes in the service delivery, which you mentioned, the amount of difference had actually shrunk into $1 million, which made it much more possible to deal with this as a budget situation. And so the situation we have right now, as they've just said, is that we have two provisions in the Health and Human Services bill that's moving forward towards the floor. One dealing with the chemical dependency treatment fund, and the other dealing with basic sliding fee child care. We do achieve equalization in the CD fund. We don't in the child care because the disparity range was just too high. And I can say that it's been good to move forward and getting and reducing the disparities as we've had to deal with tough budgets. It sees the chaos of those to sometimes make some good policy progress. I think we still have some property tax issues that we have to ultimately get to in terms of how we fund the state-local partnership. But this, the more that we can reduce the disparities, the easier that will be to achieve the original goals. But it has all been handled through a budget process at this point in time. The mental health area, which you also have a handout on, was undergoing way too much change to even begin to start to try and sort that out while we're going through significant budget reductions and reform initiatives in that area. And there's still plenty on our long list, and if others want to step up and join the effort, I appreciate Representative Lieblin doing it and the support of Representative Rood and Representative Murphy, who also serve with Man Human Services in trying to address this. It is 1 o'clock, so I think we just need to hear any concluding comments and where your next move is going to be.
Madam Chair, if I could just add a few comments on the mental health paper that should also be in your packet. That the mental health maintenance of effort is much newer. It was a critical part of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative. It does have a solid policy basis. There were county concerns. We had a stakeholder work group last year that developed some amendments, a number of amendments that were adopted by the legislature last year. We're working with counties to implement those amendments. Just a couple points I would make is that the mental health maintenance of effort does not require counties to replace reductions in state or federal funding. Essentially, the requirement is that counties maintain the net county share that they were putting in 04-05 for mental health services, and that as they get any increases, they have to use those increases to address the unmet needs, which was the intention of the Mental Health Initiative. We've also worked with counties on a number of other changes to make this more workable, and so we intend to continue doing that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Representative Lencheski.
I want to thank you, Representative Loeffler, and I know the whole committee does, and if they could all still be here, they would too. All we have to do is hearken back to that four joint committee hearing, remember, health, finance, policy, and how horrified we all were to really to begin to understand how messed up the system is. And really, I appreciate your leadership in refusing to let it go, convincing the Senate and conference committee we ought to actually even try to study it, much less do it, and then continuing pushing everyone forward to keep looking at it. And you really, it's hats off to you that we're even dealing with this, and all the people who have assisted you as well in the department.
Well, thank you, Representative Lencheski. I have to say, one of the big learnings, and I think this is for all of us, is about the legislative process. And you heard today about how one of these was nothing's been done with it since 1986, another one since 1996. And it really, as policymakers, I think, is our obligation to not just keep bringing new ideas to the table, but to really keep updating and responding to what we do. Because if you ignore things, the inequities that you start with that are small just grow exponentially, and that's the situation we've had to wrestle with. With that, the meeting is adjourned.